This week on Making Contact.
The Congress has not been consulted, and here we have foreign policy being conducted by the seat of the pants of the Bush administration, and I think this is an extremely unhealthy development.
When he was arrested, he was given no grounds of his arrest, just saying that he's a threat to the national security, and that was it.
There have been many intended and unintended consequences of what the U.S. government calls the war on terrorism. They include a crackdown on dissidents in Malaysia, a stronger U.S. foothold in the oil-rich Caspian Sea region, and around the world, widespread questioning of U.S. commitment to the rule of international law. On this program, we take a look at these three examples, drawing on reports produced during our special series, Beyond Headlines. I'm Philip Babbage, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. President Bush has often repeated that countries that harbor terrorists are just as guilty as the terrorists themselves. But what happens when the tables are turned? In just one of many examples, Haiti has requested that the U.S. return a convicted torturer who now lives in New York City. Lisa Rubman has more.
The Haitian government has repeatedly requested that the leader of a notorious paramilitary organization be returned to Haiti. The most recent request was submitted to the U.S. in December 2001. Yet Emmanuel Constant, known in Haiti by his nickname Toto Constant, continues to live and work in New York City. He founded the paramilitary group FRAP, an acronym which in Creole means to hit or beat. Constant was convicted in absentia by a Haitian jury of murder and torture and sentenced to life in prison based on substantial evidence. If he returns to Haiti, he'll be given a new trial for atrocities committed in 1991 during the overthrow of the democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. It has been estimated that during the coup d'etat, 5,000 Haitians were murdered. Andrew Redding is the director of the Americas Project and senior fellow for hemispheric affairs at the World Policy Institute in New York. He says by not returning Constant, the U.S. is breaking its own laws.
It's a very strange situation because technically speaking, he's supposed to be deported. The United States is not supposed to, under our own laws, be having former torturers being given asylum within the United States. It's not a ground for asylum. Constant was actually detained, was actually going to be removed from the United States. At that point, he went on 60 Minutes and told the United States on 60 Minutes that he'd been getting $500 a month from the CIA for 2 years, between 1992 and 1994, while the terror was going on in Haiti, and he threatened to reveal all if the U.S. were to proceed with extradition. And so at that point, a deal was struck under which he may stay in the United States for as long as he wants to, provided that he never says anything about his past connection with the CIA.
This situation has frustrated the Haitian government and enrages many Haitians, including Pierre Labossiere, who works with the Haiti Action Committee based in San Francisco Bay Area.
As the U.S. government is talking about war and terrorism, we are saying that this is clearly a double standard. And until and unless all the people who have been indicted for their activities, for their terroristic activities, are not returned to Haiti, then all this is just hypocrisy. It's mere words.
A spokesperson for the Department of Justice told Beyond Headlines that the department does not comment about extradition requests. To understand the case of Emmanuel Constant, Andrew Redding suggests we look at the early 1990s.
One has to go all the way back to the election of Jean-Bertrand Aristide as president of Haiti in 1990, and then the following year, his overthrow by a military coup. And then for the following 3 years, the military was in charge, and Constant was very closely tied to the military in his role as head of FRAP.
In 1993, the U.S. sent a Navy ship named the Harlan County to Haiti, ostensibly paving the way for President Aristide's return. Emmanuel Constant and his FRAP organization took center stage.
Constant was the guy who headed up the demonstration against the USS Harlan County, the troop ship that was set to dock in Port-au-Prince in 1993. And because of the violent demonstration on the dock led by FRAP, the troop ship turned around, and it was a major humiliation to the United States. Well, we know now that the U.S. was on both sides of this whole thing, because one of their informants was the person heading the very organization that was leading the anti-U.S. demonstration on the dock that turned away, a U.S. naval ship.
Pierre Labossiere finds it hard to believe that a group of 50 FRAP members could scare off a U.S. naval ship.
As incredible as it sounds, and as ridiculous as it sounds, and as it looked also to many reporters who were on the scene, the ship turned around. Those 500 well-armed soldiers turned around. And what was worse was that the UN decided to remove all of its personnel out of Haiti, leaving the Haitian people at the mercy of this military, that was this murderous military and this paramilitary organization called the FRAP. So it was very clear to many of us from the beginning that there was collusion between powers in the U.S. and this FRAP organization.
Aristide eventually returned to power in 1994. He and the Lavalas movement have a platform for change, democracy, human rights, and economic equality, the antidotes to the Caribbean nation's string of dictators, including Papa Doc and Baby Doc Duvalier. So why has the U.S. supported the FRAP paramilitary?
The goal was to have some kind of counter to Lavalas. Lavalas was the grassroots movement, a coalition of organizations that came together. In order, the word means a cleansing flood, in order to cleanse Haiti of the dictatorship of the ugly past and to set, to prepare the way for, to rebuild the country. So that's what the imagery was, very beautiful. And so his job was to set up something counter to Lavalas and to really force people into the old fears that they had, in to bring back an era of repression that the people of Haiti had experienced under Papa Doc and Baby Doc under the Makout system. And that was the whole idea behind FRAP.
That renewed repression was felt directly by Yolette Etienne. In June of 1992, her partner, who was a professor, was arrested and tortured, causing him to go deaf in one ear. She says the torture was directed by one of Emmanuel Constant's counterparts in the notorious Port-au-Prince police, Jackson Jaunice, who 3 months later targeted Etienne herself.
Dans local organisation femme côté moi toujours travaille, yon commande voyée par Jackson Jaunice.
At the office of a women's organization where I work, a commander sent by Jackson Jaunice illegally forced his way in and took me, detained me and two of the other women working there. They spent 4 hours interrogating me. They threatened me. There was tremendous verbal assault. They locked me up in prison. In the middle of the night, he came back again in order to terrorize me. Fortunately, I was not physically abused, but there was extraordinary verbal assault and psychological pressure.
Definitely, these guys caused a lot of terror.
Pierre Labossiere.
These are people who have killed people for no reason. These are terrorists, if there is any, by any definition of the term, and they need to be returned. And one of the problems is that in the Dominican Republic, for example, a number of them reside there. And yet they have somehow benefited from the collusion of circles within the Dominican military, as well as the U.S. military or the State Department level or Honduras or some of those countries. And they've been able they have received sheltered. They have been sheltered from prosecution. And so some of them have been so bold that they attempted two attempted coups against President Aristide. That's a real danger. It's a real threat.
Meanwhile, back in Emmanuel Constant's adopted home of New York, grassroots groups are pressing to have him return to Haiti to face justice.
For example, Leaflet, his neighborhood, where the places they know where he lives, people have gone around leafleting that neighborhood, letting the neighbors know that they have mass murder in their midst, you know. And people have demonstrated. They have demonstrated. They have written letters and called the INS, not just the INS, but also the State Department.
The U.S. government is not complying with a number of other extradition requests, according to an April 10th report issued by Amnesty International. The study, entitled United States of America, A Safe Haven for Torturers, says that by the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service's own admission, there may be as many as 1,000 human rights criminals living in the United States. The report specifically profiles torturers from a dozen countries, including Emmanuel Constant from Haiti. I'm Lisa Rudman.
You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you would like a free issue of the national newspaper, War Times, please give us a call. This publication was launched to help broaden discussion and analysis of the so-called war on terrorism. Our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. And ask for your free issue of War Times. Malaysia has been cracking down on dissidents since September 11th. Has the U.S. war on terrorism given a green light to repressive measures in Southeast Asia? According to human rights groups, Malaysia's Prime Minister, Mahathir Mohamad, has increased use of that country's Internal Security Act, or ISA, since the United States launched its war on terrorism. Under the ISA, a police officer can, without warrant, arrest and detain anyone if there's reason to believe that the individual has acted or is likely to act in any manner prejudicial to the security of Malaysia. The Internal Security Act also allows for the detention of an individual for up to 2 years with the possibility of renewal every 2 years. There are also restrictions on freedoms of assembly, association, and expression, and limits on travel, residence, and employment. As Ramit Haroon of Radik Radio in Malaysia reports, Prime Minister Mohamad's handling of dissenters has won him praise from U.S. officials.
As of November last year, there were nearly 100 persons in detention under the ISA. Secretary General for the National Human Rights Society of Malaysia, Elizabeth Wong, says the act is often invoked for political reasons to protect the ruling elite and to create a culture of fear.
I think when you have a law that detains people without trial, there will definitely be abuse of that law. So, for example, the ISA has been used very consistently since it was enacted some 40 years ago against opposition leaders, trade unionists, social workers, educationists, so on and so forth. Government has been using the ISA with impunity. I mean, there has been more than 10,000 people, most of them political detainees, who have been arrested under the ISA.
Khairul Anwar, a 24-year-old student activist, more popularly known as Jonah among Malaysian activists, was detained under the ISA in June last year. He was detained for only 24 days, but he is nevertheless traumatized by his experiences under the ISA.
I've been arrested in a reason that they say that I have threatened the national security. And at the very first moment when they handcuffed me, I've been kicked off. I've been punched on my stomach. And they said, I'm busted, I'm idiot, and everything. Then I've been blindfolded, and they took me to our office, our student organization office. And they broke into our office, and they took a lot of things. After that, I've been blindfolded again with a handcuff. And since that, I don't know where I've been for almost 25 days.
During the detention period, Jonah was put in solitary confinement and faced uninterrupted interrogation by special branch police officers for 24 hours.
They also pushed me to confess in the television. And during the interrogation, whenever I refuse to answer the question, I will be beaten up. I have to stand up in the nude, and then they asked me, whether I agree with the government or not. And I didn't answer the question. I just using my head to say that I'm not agree. And they take a kind of a wire, and they put on my penis, and they try to pull from all the side. And it's really painful, and I can't stand, and I crying because my hand is handcuffed.
After being released, he was still put under surveillance by the special branch police and faced intimidation and harassment.
They are saying that they can do anything, even to make me disappear from this country, because they say that they have the power because they are police, and as a police, they have to follow, they have to protect the current government, and to protect the current government, they can do whatever they want to do.
Bahira Tajul Aris is the wife of an ISA detainee who is currently serving 2 years detention without trial in an ISA camp. Her husband, Ezzam Muhammad Noor, was a youth leader of an opposition party.
It was like a nightmare, you know. It was such a torturous episode where my children said, when would the father come back? Why was their father being arrested? And I just told them that, your father has been arrested for trying to help people, trying to help the poor, the needy, the people who are being oppressed. Never have I imagined I would lose my husband to ISA, to Internal Security Act, a detention without trial.
And he may never have a chance to plead his case to the public. The mainstream media in Malaysia are owned directly or indirectly by the ruling elite, and governed by restrictive law and regulations.
Imagine having the media telling people, the public, that your husband, the father of my children, is trying to topple the government in militant way. That's rather an unfair statement. When he was arrested, he was given no grounds of his arrest, just saying that he's a threat to the national security, and that was it. So the children had a tough and difficult time.
Critics of the ISA, who in the past included the US State Department, have been less vocal since the September 11 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Elizabeth Wong explained further.
For Malaysia, it's a great opportunity, to take advantage of the current global political situation, to exploit the nervousness and the insecurities of the US government and use it in return to get better trade relationships, better political relationships, and at the same time continue to constrict and limit our democratic space in the name of combating terrorism.
The picture painted by Elizabeth Wong has become even clearer after a visiting senior US official on April 8 praised Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, who has been in power for more than 20 years.
Since September 11th, we have seen a lot of clampdowns and crackdowns. People have been accused of being so-called Islamic militants, have been detained, a great number of them. And in many ways, we also believe that is to make the US government happy, that Malaysia is at least seen to be combating terrorism.
I'm Rahmat Harun in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Expansion of the Bush administration's war on terrorism into former Soviet republics has meant that a multitude of interests involving the world's largest oil producers and the largest oil consumer are converging. The United States established military presences in Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kazakhstan to assist in the war in Afghanistan. and the United States has ventured into the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, where Chechen rebels with alleged links to Al-Qaeda are reportedly taking refuge in a mountainous region known as the Pankisi Gorge. In February 2002, Russia's leader of the Communist Party said that the U.S. move to supply military trainers, advisors, and equipment to Georgia was, quote, another link in a chain of global invasion by the United States. Russian President Vladimir Putin said later that it was, quote, no tragedy that U.S. troops would be stationed there. Situated on the western coast of the oil-rich Caspian Sea, Georgia is engaged in a power struggle with Russia and, like other Caspian regions, could prove a vital platform for harnessing vast oil reserves nearby. Michael Clare is professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts, and author of Resource Wars, The New Landscape of Global Conflict.
Georgia is a very strategically located state. It borders on Chechnya, which of course has been a scene of intense fighting over the past few years, and also Azerbaijan, which is a new source of energy, oil, for the United States. And the United States has expectations of pumping a lot of oil from Azerbaijan and adjacent countries through Georgia to the Black Sea and to Turkey and to the Mediterranean in the future. So there's a lot of concern about the stability and security of Georgia in the years ahead. And this concern preceded September 11th, but has only increased since then because there are reports of Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists or insurgents in the Pankisi Valley north of Tbilisi, the capital, on the Chechnya border. So the United States is preparing to work with the Georgian military to enhance their capacity to fight those insurgents and terrorists.
The Pentagon hasn't provided exact details on U.S. military involvement in Georgia, but as many as 200 U.S. military advisors could wind up there. And according to some reports, the United States has already provided 10 Huey helicopters to Georgia. While the Bush administration hasn't provided evidence that Chechen rebels in Georgia have links to Al-Qaeda, analysts who are following the situation closely have little doubt that this is the case. But going after so-called terrorists in the former Soviet Republic could have serious implications for the domestic situation there, says Thomas Valasek, a senior analyst at the Center for Defense Information based in Washington, D.C. Georgia is in a state of turmoil. Some of its provinces are attempting to break away, including those of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Valasek says that Georgia could use U.S. assistance not solely for combating alleged terrorists in the Pankisi Gorge, but to quell rebellion elsewhere.
There is a chance that if the United States does train and equip rapid reaction forces of the Georgia military to fight in the Pankisi Gorge, that these forces may later be used in places like Abkhazia in an attempt to regain control over some of these breakaway provinces. And there is also a danger that Georgia may use the aid to basically try to assert itself against Russia, as a tool against Russia. There are already some statements coming up from the Georgian government that these troops are in fact a sign of a sort of a strategic solidarity between the United States and Georgia over oil pipelines, whatnot. And these statements are clearly can only be interpreted as a slap at Russia.
The situation in Georgia presents many complications for U.S.-Russian relations. The presence of U.S. troops in the Pankisi Gorge could help Russia in dealing with Chechen rebels, who Russian officials label as terrorists. On the other hand, both the United States and Russia are vying for control over oil resources in the Caspian region. There's already one major oil pipeline in Georgia and another one in the works. Russia is the second largest oil exporter in the world, following Saudi Arabia, which possesses about 25% of the known oil reserves in the world. Saudi Arabia's unique position gives it enormous influence over world oil prices. But Russia has been the only oil-producing country that has not had to succumb to Saudi pressure to lower oil production to keep prices high. In fact, Russia has substantially increased oil production, forcing prices down. With oil demand in the United States expected to increase from 77 million barrels per day to 120 million barrels per day in 20 years, the U.S. is looking for stable oil-producing countries while decreasing its dependence on the largest oil-producing states, which could wield economic and political leverage. So is there more than simply a war on terrorism going on in Central Asia? Mel Goodman, a former senior analyst on the Soviet Union for the CIA from 1966 to 1986, is professor of international security at the National War College and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He's also the co-author, along with his wife Carolyn Ekdahl, of the book The War of Edward Shevardnadze, who's the current president of Georgia.
Well, I don't think the battle with terrorism is a cover right now. I think that is the issue, because we had a lot of time to consider closer relations with Georgia. President Shevardnadze in Georgia has wanted this kind of relationship as he tries to create some leverage with the Russians. We had ample reason over the energy matters to improve that dialogue with Shevardnadze, but it's not an opportunity that we took. I think it's the battle over terrorism that is the driving force. But this could easily grow into a stronger stake for the United States and Georgia because of energy. One will lead to the other. So I don't think energy is the strategic interest that's driving us now, but I think the tactics over terrorism will lead to an interest with regard to oil and natural gas.
But Tom Valasek of the Center for Defense Information says that the United States has more to gain by strengthening its ties with Russia.
To look at the U.S. involvement in Georgia as something motivated by oil interest, I think would be inaccurate, precisely because the United States, in fact, stands to gain much more from a cooperation with Russia. It was Russia which, through its policy of essentially non-compliance with OPEC rules, has kept oil prices low during this entire crisis since September 11th. Russia has much bigger oil deposits than any of the Caspian states, in fact, than all of them together. And to think that the United States would go into Georgia because of its oil interests and would do so in effect against Russia's opposition, that would be very very short-sighted, very misguided.
At the same time, the convergence of terrorist links and oil politics is unmistakable in the Caspian region. Former CIA senior analyst Mel Goodman heeds caution.
Well, I think it's important that people keep in mind that we are now moving into the Caucasus. It's a modest amount of military force. We're only talking about 100 to 200 military there, mainly as trainers. But we know nothing about this region. This is one of the most complicated regions in the world today. It's been a cradle of conflict over the years, over centuries. We don't study it. We don't take it seriously. We've gone ahead with this move into Georgia without any debate, without any discussion. It's not part of a coherent strategic framework. The Congress has not been consulted. And here we have foreign policy being conducted by the seat of the pants of the Bush administration. And I think this is an extremely unhealthy development.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at a few of the consequences of the U.S. war on terrorism. Thanks for listening. As we mentioned earlier in this broadcast, if you want a free issue of the national newspaper War Times, please give us a call at the National Radio Project. The publication was launched to help broaden discussion and analysis of the so-called war on terrorism. Our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also go to our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Laura Labate is our acting executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, Women's Desk director Lisa Rudman, associate producer Amy Pomerleau, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national producer David Barsamian, administrative coordinator Rosalind Fay, executive assistant Doreen Hinton, and I'm your host and managing producer Philip Babbage. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.